Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM. It's time now for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
One 1% of the children in the U.S. ages 3 through 17 is believed to have an autism spectrum disorder, and 1 to 1.5 million Americans believed to live with the disorder. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. It's also been reported that there has been an 1,100% in the growth rate of this disorder. We'll take a look at that. And this morning, we want to explore this disability and the resources to manage it. To get a clear picture of how that is going on here on the Eastern Shore, we have Judy Cornett. She's a speech and language pathologist and is coordinator of the clinical services at Benedictine, where she has been since 1977. She's also a consultant at the Chesapeake Center. Also, Bonnie Lormer is a parent educator for Parents Place of Maryland and working with families on the Eastern Shore. And also, Crystal Holman, and she is a parent of a child who has autism and is also the executive director of Autism Chapter Eastern Shore. So first of all, I want to welcome you to the program.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, I want to turn to you because you have firsthand experience. Tell me a little bit about, and let's sort of reach back here. When was the first did you realize that your child had autism, this disorder? And, I mean, what was your reaction? Give us a picture of that, because most people don't have any sense, you know, sort of like there they see it. But it doesn't just spring out of nowhere.
Well, with my son, he was a normal little boy in the beginning, and he was a 10-pound healthy little child. And somewhere between 18 months to 2, he changed so fast it was outrageous. He stopped looking at us. He stopped touching things. You couldn't hug him or hold him. He would run through the house like his body was on fire. His behavior started getting more and more violent, and we couldn't understand why. And he absolutely stopped speaking. We went from words to nothing. And so I went from doctor to doctor, 3 doctors. They kept saying, spoiled child, all these different things that were going wrong. And I said, I just can't imagine this, because I had another child who was very polite, very kind, very obedient, and just a perfect girl. And I did not know what to do, but when the 4th doctor came in and I talked to the 4th doctor, he said, do you know what autism is? I think your son has autism. Have you ever seen the movie Rain Man? And I was frozen. I didn't know what to do. I went home. All I knew about autism was it was a neurological dysfunction of the brain. I did not know anything else about it. So I went home and I just started online and searching everything I could search. What is it? How do you get it? How does this happen to a normal child? And from there, we ended up getting the specialists from Kennedy Krieger, and they said when they did all the testing that my son had severe autism with sensory integration dysfunction and pervasive developmental disorder, and he was pretty much the worst case scenario. At that point, the doctors told us, there is nothing we can do for your son. Go home and prepare for the future, but your son is probably going to be put in an institution.
And what year, when was this? What year?
He was 2.5 years old.
Okay.
So
He's 12 now. Okay. Yes. So, and how did your family react to this? I mean, how did they handle it?
Well, I want to tell you, at first, beyond devastation, but we didn't even have time to mourn. We had to jump into action. I literally read for 3 days. I don't even think I slept. But through the grace of God,
sure,
we found the strength to move on and help my son. And we went to a place where I got in touch with the right people, and they told me what to do, and I started putting together a plan. And now through you know, jumping in and doing 10 hours a day, 60 hours a week for the last 8 years, even though it was a massive struggle, and my son was so severe, I mean, he was beating me 15 to 19 times a day, so our life was like living with a little animal. And we just jumped in and started working with him. And now he's at 12,000 words. He speaks French, German, Spanish, and he's amazing. As of right now, he is on soccer teams. He's on bowling teams. He does swimming. He does Horseback riding, and he's great at golf. He's phenomenal, and we can go anywhere and do everything. So our life has changed so much.
Let me ask you about the well, one thing you said that struck me is that you didn't have time to mourn, and it's like losing a child. Is it what it sounds
is,
like?
It is because the child that you knew,
right.
This beautiful little boy, has changed so much that you can't even understand what happened. He's like, I mean, I don't know how to explain it except for an animal. If you were to try to baptize a tiger in full water, that type of fighting and scratching and clawing was my son, and it was from sunup to sundown. He never slept. He was like an animal.
Now, but then you saw this transition, what was that like? And can give you some sense about the stage where you got a sense like, well, maybe there's some light at the tunnel here.
Well, we ended up getting a hold of Dr. Christina Cardo, and she's from over the bridge. And she came. She's a behavioral specialist. And she came and she started working with us and showing us how to do verbal ABA. And she says the language is in there, and we have to pull it out. And we have to make sure that this child understands our world is more exciting than the world that he's trying to withdraw himself into. And we started working with my son, and a long story short, she says, wait till he wants something really badly on a day that he's hungry or something, and try to pull the language out. So I had a bag of chips, and I said, say chip. And he wanted the chips, and there was no one home, it was just him and I. And I said, say chip, say chip. He didn't do it. He screamed. He yelled. He fought. He screaming, crying. And it was about 4 hours later, and I'm ready to cave, and I'm literally screaming at God, going, you've got to be kidding me. I'm ready to rip my own spine out, and my son is still having this fit. And at the end of the 4 hours, he says, "Ch," and I knew at that point that he had it. The next time I did it again, it was like 3 hours of screaming, and he said, "Ch," and he got it out more. By the third time, it was about an hour and a half of screaming, and he said, chip, and I gave him the whole bag. He ate the whole bag of chips that day. And I knew that it was in there.
We want to turn to Judy Cornett, speech and language pathologist. And language is like one of those like keys, right? I mean,
Absolutely. That
seems to be the one thing that particularly is missing because, in part, because language is the kind of thing that we really kind of relate to one another.
I mean,
that's how we become socialized, that we move through society, that we achieve our goals. Tell me a little bit about, she described how she tried, you know, finally got her son to say chip. But give us a sense about that pathology. I mean, what's going on that doesn't allow for that language to come out, especially as she mentioned a moment ago, the child was, and I've read some of the literature where the child can seem very, very normal, very, very early on with words, and then suddenly they just disappear.
And a lot of that is what, you know, you were talking about is creating the need and taking advantage of their interests and their strengths, but also understanding the issues that they have that challenge their ability to use language, the sensory issues which are involved, which are just huge. But developing that need and that interest in something external, because they can pretty much satisfy their own needs internally if allowed to do so. So our job is to pull them out of that and present the need for them to communicate and then always be there, as you were, to respond right away, because they don't understand the reciprocal nature of language. So we have to teach them that this is how you manipulate your environment, that it's not going to work through behavior. It's going to work through using some form of communication. At our school, over half of our students are nonverbal, so they use different kinds of technology like iPads or different computer systems in which to speak. But the basic concept is still the same, developing the need and their desire to communicate.
She went much more to go is that she knew the words were there. Are the words in there? I mean, or is it they've... Or say some pathology that blocks them from coming out.
What
do we have any
there.
Sense about that?
The language is there. Whether it's verbal words, whether it's gestures, sign language, use of pictures, the communication is there. What we need to develop in them is the need to communicate. because their world is so difficult and so challenging and so scary that it's easier for them to withdraw within themselves.
Well, why is it scary?
You know, I think a lot of it, I'm very aware of the sensory experiences that they have no filter. So all of their sensory information comes in at the same level. So everything that we're able to block out, they're not able to block that out. And that's a scary world if everything comes in at that level. So you would withdraw. I mean, I think typical people would withdraw if they were overpowered by all of those sensory experiences. But we have the knowledge and the problem-solving skills and the choice to go someplace typical. Take a walk, be quiet, read a book, something like that. And these children don't know how to do that. They don't know how to, and they're not able to filter out that information. So they've withdrawn to themselves. It's a very scary world.
Crystal, were you aware of this analysis about what was happening to your child in the sense of not being able to filter this thing out? That
not in the very beginning.
Yeah.
However, what I did do is through Autism Chapter Eastern Shore, I started bringing in the experts. And through the journey, like we brought Temple Grand in, Dr. Day, she's mm-hmm. a survivor of autism and teaches around the world what it's like to be autistic. And that was one of my first conferences out in Cambridge, Maryland. And we had 625 people attend that conference. Through the specialists that have come, Jed Baker, Tony Atwood, Carol Koranowitz. Carol Koranowitz wrote The Out of Sync Child. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge one to explain why are they having such sensory issues. You don't think about the sensory going haywire in your system, but when you have someone and you touch them softly, and to that child that feels like barbed wire, then you have to touch in a different way because the harder touch felt better to the child.
They can interpret it.
Yes, and you don't know that as a mother. You're just thinking of regular, you know, how to be with a child. And you're thinking, if you have other children, then of course you put that parenting into place. And everything you know about parenting gets thrown out door when you have a child with autism. You're used to saying, get off that chair and stop that and sit down. Mm-hmm. Well, with a child with autism, you can't say that. You have to ignore the bad behavior and absolutely praise when they are sitting nicely. Great job sitting. Good job. Good boy. And praise the good and forget about the bad. And you ignore it.
Because they don't know the bad is bad.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not a purposeful act. It's their, and if you've read any of Temple Grandin's book, it's their way of dealing with a very scary environment. Mm-hmm. So their behavior, I don't like to call it behavior because I think behavior is something that is volitional.
Mm-hmm.
And these children are just reacting to a very scary situation for them. So they're not perceiving this as something mommy doesn't want me to do or something I should not do. They don't have that perception that a typical child would have.
Bonnie, I want to turn to you. You're a parent educator and you're with Parents Place of Maryland. In dealing with parents, I mean, what is your experience when parents come to you and have this, was clearly, as Crystal describes, this sort of shock that everything that you thought was going to happen, particularly for your child, it's not going to happen. What's your experience with parents?
Well, I can come from experience myself because I also have a son that has autism.
Mm, okay.
And have been advocating for children with special needs since I was 4 years old because I had a brother that was a special needs child. So when you, as Crystal said, when you first find out that your child has a disability, you run around frantically trying to find the resources. You're making hundreds of telephone calls. Lots of people don't call you back. It's a dead-end street, and you're exhausted. So from that experience, I decided, you know, when I became a parent educator with the Parents Place of Maryland, that I was going to help parents not have to go through those steps. I'm there to help teach them to navigate, to better learn about their special health care needs of their child and the special education needs, which is a piece that involves the IEP process in our public school systems were the majority of the calls that I received. I served 9 counties on the Eastern Shore, Cecil County to Somerset. Mm-hmm. So most parents call me, like Crystal, in the beginning, frantic. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing, you know, we have an intake process, but I always let my parents know they're not speaking to a stranger. I always tell them that I have a child with special needs. I've been through what you're going through. Take a deep breath. Let's do these things. Let's start out with a few priorities and get them calmed down, because they're all in a crisis when they call me. So I use my personal experience, and that helps de-escalate. And then we can get to work on how are we going to best have your child receive the services that they need. And we have workshops in the area all over the state to help educate parents. So, I do serve your county, as I mentioned, right. 9 counties. And I have a lot of families in your county that need assistance. That I get more calls from this county than any county of the 9 counties that I serve.
So when you talk to these parents, how easily do they find themselves to say, okay, I have to take a breath, I have to stand back? Or
it depends on the individual. Every personality is different.
Sure.
Sometimes I have to spend a longer amount of time with a parent. Living in the area that we live, not every parent is able to read or write, mm-hmm. and there's economical challenges in the area, rural. So it depends on the personality. Usually with the experience that I have come from, and I'm also a trained mediator, I know how to say and do certain things to help them get calmed down, and they feel better. And then they'll invest more in learning to help their family situation.
So Crystal, this process, we were talking about how your child is improving. When did you realize that his social skills, which is obviously a key part of language, but also discerning what mm-hmm. people are
yes.
thinking even without them saying anything, right?
Yes.
When did you realize that, well, maybe that this child of yours was not going to be what people have, obviously, of images of films and so on, of Rain Man, as it were,
yes.
to something that someone who can learn languages.
I think it was, as far as socially,
yeah.
I know it was 6 years ago.
Mm.
Between 5 to 6 years ago, he changed so much. And all I know is that I've been explained to it as, if you have the power cord and you've got this the serger where you've got many things plugged in, and each of these wires, if you imagine them cut, so all these different things in his little sensory system is messed up, and then we're trying to go back and fix it. So basically, I'm putting the duct tape around each of these things so that his little body is not charged with this mess, and the fear and the absolute unbelievable challenges that he had. I mean, giving him a bath, it took 5 people mm-hmm. to put him in the water just to bathe him. I had no idea that the water felt like concrete to his mm-hmm. body. I did not know that it felt like acid burning his body, and it was just water. We were only using water. We didn't even put soap on him because we were so afraid of the reaction of the water that I was mortified to use soap. So we didn't understand all that. So as we're going through and we're working with him and working with him, and then we're doing water games and we're playing with water and making him feel it and making him touch it, he becomes desensitized, I guess is the word.
That's right.
And playing with rice and playing with rice and putting mm-hmm. rice on his mm-hmm. body, and then getting the little... they're real soft, and you put them, and you tickle, and you tickle, and you tickle, and it's that soft touch and getting him used to it. Well, then he's desensitized to anyone touching him. He just woke up one day, and of course, we are a very faith-based home,
mm-hmm.
and we prayed for him and prayed for... no more fear, no more, you can do anything, telling him he's a child of God. And it ended up that he just woke up one morning And he says, Hayden has no fear. And he walks downstairs and he says, I want to go here, I want to go there, I want to go here, I want to go there. And we were like running out the door with him, absolutely thrilled that he wanted to go someplace. Because basically I've been almost shut in my home for 4 or 5 years. I mean, I would go to therapy and come home, but a day out with my son was so exhausting. And people were not... gentle
right.
on their words. I have one story where I was coming out of the grocery store. I'm trying to put him in the car seat. And as I'm putting my son in my own car, and he's, you know, 3.5, 4 years old, this gentleman saw us, and the man starts yelling at me in the parking lot going, you're a horrible mother. You've got a horrible child. You need to wrap a rope around his neck and drag him till dead. And they said this in front of my daughter, who was 9 years old at the time. And I was just shaking, and I thought, I can't believe he's saying this. And of course, my daughter's present, so I have to watch what I say. And I turned back to this gentleman and I said, since you're so interested in my life, please read about autism, because your ignorance is showing to the disability and you don't understand what is going on with my son. And I said, I'm going to go home and pray for you to learn that when you speak, to think before you speak. And I got in the car and I'm shaking so bad. And my daughter says, what are you going to do, Mommy? I can't believe they want my brother dead. And I said, no, honey, he doesn't understand. We're going to go home and pray for him and pray for everyone that's like him. And we came home and we said the little prayer. And then I went in my closet and I cried like a baby. Because I thought, I didn't kill anybody today. No. But it was one of those moments, because it was overwhelming for this man to say this. And it just viciously attacked me.
So is he now able to talk about what that was like? Has he talked at all about that? Or what does he say?
My son remembers everything. Mm. He remembers everything. He actually, as of this point, he is at 12 years old now. He remembers back when we did therapy at the other house that we used to live in, which was, of course, 8 years ago. And he was only 3 years old, mind you, you know, 3.5. And he says, yeah, that's where Hayden did this, and that's where I did this. And he's talking about, yeah, Mommy's been my teacher for a long time. He remembered every assistant we had through Dub Point. He's remembered all the different girls that have come in my home and helped me with help my son. And then, of course, now we have boys and girls for my son. But he... his whole world now, there was a day he's driving, he's with my mother, and he says, Grandma, I want you to turn here, and I want you to turn here, and I want you to turn here. And he says, oh, see this place here? I used to horseback ride right here. And she was like, oh, he didn't do that since he was 4, you know. So it was overwhelming that he remembered. Mm-hmm. And he remembered every place that we had been, went to, and even to the point of what day and date. Mm. He'll say, Mommy, August 2005, you pulled over on Riverside Drive to get away from that police officer that was going fast behind us. He remembers things like this. Mm-hmm. Of course, the police officer had an emergency, don't they? But he remembers things like that. He'll say, yep, that was August 2005.
Does he talk at all about what it was like? I mean, because you were talking about fear. Does he talk about that? Did he say that he was fearful? Or
he tells me that he was afraid of everything.
Mm.
He was afraid of the noises. He was afraid of the light bulbs. That was the weirdest part, was when he was telling me that. And then he tells me that, of course, he was very afraid of the water. He was afraid once you got in the water, you never came out. And he was afraid of... ever missing his routine. We would have a routine when we'd go to therapy. Then if he was good at therapy, then we'd stop and get fries and then, you know, come on home. Well, there was one day where I forgot the routine that when he was little, and he remembers breaking the car seat in half and beating me down the highway. And he tells me, Mommy, I remember, he says, remember when Hayden got out of the car seat and I hit Mommy? I said, yes, I do. And he says, Hayden didn't mean that. And I said, I know you didn't. He says, that wasn't very nice. And I said, well, Mommy understands what happened. You had a definite communication frustration, and that's why he acted out in violence.
One of the things I'm curious about, when you talk about, one of the things that seems to emphasize is this whole concept of touch. And I'm kind of curious, Judy, you know, you specialize in language, but there seems to be this this physical component, as she was describing, in terms of the world. I mean, not only just finding it difficult to express oneself in terms of I don't like this, I don't like that, but I mean, so that there seems to be two pieces of this puzzle.
Well, you know, and it truly is a puzzle, and you really can't segment the pieces. Where I work, we have occupational therapists, physical therapists, special educators, counselors, psychologists, and you treat the whole child. I can do a sensory diet, what they call doing these sensory activities with the student, while I'm doing language therapy or while I'm working on their communication system, because it's all integrated. These children cannot segment out what they're supposed to be doing. Everything comes to them at the same intensity. So even being near me, the color that I'm wearing, if I'm wearing jewelry that's distracting, if I'm wearing a fragrance that they find, you know, difficult, we try to wear clothing that is calming. You know, we learn about colors that are calming. We use aromatherapy. All of these things so that the child can open up and feel safe, which is the only way you can learn. If you're scared and you're always trying to keep the world away, you really aren't able to learn.
I want to ask you about, because we're talking about clearly what seems to be a success here, but are we giving people the wrong impression that for instance, Crystal's success is not necessarily, I mean, obviously it's not easily duplicated, and this was not easy for her either, but that there's just some children or some who have autism who are not going to recover. I mean, any one of you. I mean,
it's a spectrum. I mean, and that's why it's called a spectrum. So, yeah. And it has many other disabilities and abilities interwoven into it. So, you know, you can't predict how far a child's going to come. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so in the past, people would refer to like their overall functioning level, and they're never going to achieve anything higher than that. Well, that's not true with children with autism, because there's so many different aspects of their abilities. You have to just keep on trying and find the door. And it's really a challenge for the people working with them. It's our job to get inside there and figure out how to open up those doors, because the children can't do it for themselves.
Well, by the way, one of the statistics I ran across was, I think it was 1,100% growth rate in at least the reports of this disorder. Is that just simply because we're becoming aware of it? Is it a redefinition? What are we looking at? Any one of you? I guess it's the experts over here.
I think it's a combination of it is a neurological impairment. There are different things that we can actually look at and say, yes, these are signs and symptoms. There's also an environmental component, which nobody really knows what that is. So are we diagnosing them better? Yes. However, I mean, I've been in the field 40 years, and the children that I'm seeing now, I didn't see anything like that 40 years ago.
What's different?
The intensity of their needs, and it's just, it's so obvious when you see these children that they are struggling to get out of themselves and to be part of the world. And I don't remember seeing that 40 years ago.
I can tell you that even the first time I ever saw a commercial, it was in the 80s or 70s, because I was like teenage years, and it was like 1 in 10,000 then, and they said, you know, my autistic child, and I thought, okay, what is that? So that's the day I looked it up and saw that it was neurological dysfunction, because I thought, wait a minute, are they, you know, what are they upset about with the child? I didn't read anything else about it, and I never heard anything else about it. But I can tell you the different information that I have read. Like they were saying 1 in 88 and 1 in 49 in some of the other counties, I mean, depending on what state you're in. Well, just since 9/11, there's over a 12,806% jump. Mm-hmm. And through that jump, just since 9/11, I know that when we did the blood tests, where we checked the chromosomes and does he have Fragile X, my son, does he have any abnormalities, what is wrong, why is this happening? And we only did this because my daughter at age 10 says, Mommy, would I ever have a baby with autism? And I about had a small stroke.
Right.
I said, you're right, we got to find out.
Sure.
Well, I didn't want the testing because I didn't want to blame, oh, it's my husband's fault or my fault, or, you know, I didn't want to do the blame game. But then when my daughter said that, I said, we have to, and my husband agreed. We took him in, and there were nothing. There was no abnormalities for Hayden. There are no chromosome damage. There's no fragile X. There's no rhyme or reason for him to have this. However, the other side of that is that we had read that if there's nothing showing up, then we have a greater chance to allow him to have success in coming out of it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I worked on. I don't want to work on how bad was it going to get. What can I do to help him? Mm-hmm. So we did the diet, nutrition, gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free, milk-free. I mean, everything that I could possibly do, the vitamins, the herbs, the cleansings, whatever I could do at home, I did it all. Mm-hmm. So,
Bonnie, I want to ask you, because one of the things you do is you're in charge of parents' place of Maryland, and you deal with parents and trying to deal. What kind of resources are there on the peninsula? I mean, this is a rural area. This is not a big city where you have lots and lots of people and so on. Particularly if you have someone has a child who they think has autism or they've been having problems, where do they go? How do they figure out?
I would say 95% of the children that I work with are diagnosed with being in a spectrum along with co-occurring disorders. Three-quarters of them go to Kennedy Krieger, AI DuPont, Children's in Washington, D.C. That is one of the issues that we struggle with here on the shore. We used to have a very wonderful developmental pediatrician that lived in Cambridge. She is retired. She did work with children on the spectrum. We do have some other resources in Centerville, Maryland, where there are some clinical social workers and psychiatrists that work with children. But it's very difficult here. Families are traveling far away to get the assistance. And the biggest thing is there needs to be more supports, more doctors to come to the shore, which is a very difficult. Doctors don't like to leave the Western Shore to come here. Resources in schools, staff having more training, understanding the sensory, speech. This seems to be a big lack here on the Western Shore. You have more trained staff. You have more resources in your school system. Over here, we do not. There's just a complete lack of training and understanding of autism. When you hear the word autism on the shore, my perception is negativity and behavior, aggressive biting children. They need to be thrown in a self-contained classroom. You know, we can't help them. So we need more supports. These children are very intelligent and very bright children. Mm-hmm. Their IQs are usually very, very high. But because of those sensory issues, processing issues, touch, etc., their behavior gets in the way because they can't help it.
Right.
They can't filter it out. So as far as resources, the Parents Place of Maryland's been around since 1991. We were created by a group of parents of children with special needs. We are a nonprofit, federally funded, and we work all over this state. Every state has either one or two PTIs, Parent Training Information mm-hmm. Centers. And we are in the federal guidelines to help these parents. And so most of my calls that come in are children that are attending the public school system. More and more are coming in where they've decided to homeschool their children because they're not able to find the resources and the supports that they need in their public school system.
Right.
And that always comes down to the dollar, basically.
And of course, I mean, one of the things I mentioned before we wrapped this up, and one of the things that you talked about, Crystal, you talked about staying home.
Yes.
And of course, there are a lot of parents they can't do that. Right. So I'm sure that that's a difficult thing. We could probably spend another half hour talking about that.
Yes.
Judy Cornett, a speech and language pathologist, also coordinator of clinical services at Benedictine, where she's been since 1977. Bonnie Lorimer is a parent educator for Parents Place of Maryland, which is working with families on the Eastern Shore. And my special thanks to Crystal Holman, who's come in and talked about her child, and I really appreciate you, sharing this story.
And the whole reason we are here is because we do have an event coming up.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Awesome.
Yeah,
what's the
event? Yes, go ahead.
Well, it's going to be on November the 9th at Allen Memorial Church, and from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon, and lunch and brunch will be provided, and we are going to have an entire segment on education for the parents, mm-hmm. anything from birth to the teen years, and the dating.
21.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have the specialists come, and they're all going to be speaking in all their segments. Bonnie Lairmore will be there for
the IEPs,
and they have to just get in touch with Pathfinders or Parents Place of Maryland or the Benedictine School to get more information for the brochure. But it is going to be a fun day. But the information and the education that the parents will get from this event will be priceless.
And it's free.
Yes, and we have made it where it's free. Because of the economy being a little different, we wanted to make sure that their parents are not going to have to pay to come and see and learn this information.
And just so you know, the Parents Place of Maryland, we do not charge for anything that we do to a parent. Everything we do is free.
I appreciate you all coming back and sharing your stories. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This hour is sponsored by Rise Up Coffee Roasters, serving the shore at three locations, Salisbury, St. Michael's, and their roastery and cafe in Easton. With the change of seasons comes a variety of fall favorites, including pumpkin spice lattes and the great pumpkin muffin. More information can be found online at riseupcoffee.com.
Hi, I'm Rick Steves. I believe the more we know and understand about our world, the more fun it is to explore. We're all in the same traveler's school of hard knocks, and it's okay to share notes. Let's spend an hour together each week exploring the places and people that make our world so inviting. And we can share tips that help turn our travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. Monday nights at 8 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
I'm Lisa Mullins. A shift in the global economy can threaten your job. Politics in the Middle East can change what you pay to fill her up. A disease that kills chickens in Asia can affect public health in America. Every day, our reporters examine world events and their effect on life here in the United States. Keep up with your world on PRI's The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on WSDL 90.7 FM.
And welcome back to Delmarva Today, and this is Don Rush. And next month, the community players are putting on a production of the musical Les Miserables, and John Wesley Wright has been cast in the role of Jean Valjean. And, of course, Les Miserables began actually as a French-language concept album, and the first musical stage adaptation actually appeared in Paris. A sports arena there in 1980. An English version opened in 1985 in conjunction with the Royal Shakespeare Company. And now the community players here in Salisbury are taking up the challenge. And we are happy to have John Wesley Wright, who is featured. Tell me a little bit about the decision here to have this play. It's fairly ambitious. I mean, I actually watched the movie because I want to get a better sense of like what was happening. And I'm sure you're going to do just a much better job. But nonetheless, how did this happen?
How did this happen? Well, I can tell you from my part of the story.
Right.
There's a wonderful lady, a retired musician, choral director in town. Her name is Phyllis Oldham, and sung at Trinity United Methodist, where she's the director, several times. And so we have a little bit of a history here, and it's quite simple. She said, we're going to take on this very ambitious Les Mis project, and we want to exploit the university a bit and its talent. And that's how that happened. So she and the director came over and scouted some of our vocal talent and said, hey, would you happen to be interested as well? And so I said, yes.
Why not?
Why not?
By the way, I want to remind our people that we are in the midst of our membership drive. This is actually the last of our membership drive day, the last day. And we need you to pick up the phone now and dial 410-543-6895. That is the number to call if you appreciate, for instance, the discussion we had in the first half hour about autism. And I think it was some really interesting insight into the disorder and what it's like, particularly for the child who must look at the world through a very, as some of them described, very scary set of sensory perceptions. If you appreciate what we did there, now's the time to pick up the phone and dial 410-543-6895. And if you are, by the way, a great enthusiast of the Salisbury Community Players, I suggest that you pick up the phone now and dial 410-543-6895. Or John Wesley Wright, there's...
Jean Valjean is going to renew his membership this morning as well, so I'm going to challenge everyone else.
That's
to do
right.
The same.
And so let me ask you about the what sense, first of all, obviously you have read the play. What sense do you get about the meaning of this play, especially as it relates to what's going on? What spoke to you about this play?
Well, I have had the privilege. I was about 20 years in the Ohio, Cincinnati, Dayton area, and I actually had several experiences with working with incarcerated folks, and actually made a CD two different times, a CD project with incarcerated men, and so. This whole idea of getting another chance, you know, having a second chance, redemption, there are just so many universal themes in Les Mis, and I didn't understand, because I didn't know the show that well until now, what all the fuss was about. So many folks just are over the top in love with the show, and I was not really. I finally get it.
Right.
So there's just so many characters, young characters, older characters, you know, troubled characters that folks relate to, and that's there's just so many. Different themes and that you can relate to in the show, I believe.
Again, the number is 410-543-6895. We also have in studio, by the way, is Harold Wilson. He does our writer's edition. I'm assuming that you have some familiarity with Les Miserables, whether it's a book or as a – what do you think? What do you think is the meaning you think of?
Well, I think that Les Mis is a wonderful piece of work, and I agree with you that it sounds like a very ambitious production. But I'm sure that the community players of Salisbury are putting together a top rate. Production.
Yeah, I'm going to chime in there. I've heard this all around town when during this the initial prep for this. Wow, that's so ambitious! I can't believe it. Can community players really do this? I want to ask our community: are you aware of how much incredible talent there is on the shore? Because if you're not. You're going to see it. I always like to flip this idea of instead of do you have the talent to do that? You should be surprised if you don't. If you live in a community where there isn't the talent, then run to another community, because that's what it's all about. I mean, there's a lot of talent on the shore. And it came out. There was close to 200 folks who auditioned for this. And you've got the best of the best.
If you're talking about the cast, and I sort of have this piece of paper in front of me, which has got looks like a zillion people, and as you're staging this, I mean, is this going to be an elaborate set? Do you know, or how are they going to do that?
I think that there are elaborate elements to it, and there the stage director and Sharon Bankoff is. Has a wonderful vision. Her son is the lighting designer. I think that we don't have that traditional turn style that you see when you associate with Les Mis, when you think of the Broadway London shows. But there are many creative ways around that, and I think that there's a raised platforms and idea concept that will work and work for the space at Y-High.
Again, we want to remind people that we are in the last day of our membership drive, and the number to call is 410-543-6895. I'm not sure we have any calls. One should be the first person in this break to pick up the phone and dial that number. Again, it's 410-543-6895. And we have it on record here. John Wesley Reddy is going to renew his membership, so he cannot escape. We'll track you down.
Absolutely.
One of the things I did want to ask you about, you participate, for instance, in the American Spiritual Ensemble, and one of the things, obviously, you're African-American. What is your African-American experience? How does that relate, do you think, to the role that you have? Because, for instance, I remember in listening to some of the American Spiritual Ensemble, there's a lot of songs that particularly come out of slavery, come out of that period and that kind of thing. How does your experience or your heritage allow you to relate to this character that you have?
Well, wow, that's a good question. Well, I have to say, one of the things once I got to know the role better is how surprised I am that there, as far as I know, has not been an African-American cast in the role of Jean Valjean.
Right.
You see sometimes the role of Javert cast as an African-American. And I find that odd. African-American would represent the establishment at that time. It makes to me perfect sense that you would have the experience of someone who comes from a troubled background and then shows a redemption and has this journey from being incarcerated to making something out of his life that makes a lot of sense that an African-American could play a role like that. So.
Yeah, actually, I have to admit, I'm actually surprised that there hasn't been before. I mean, it just seemed like a perfect fit, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And for that reason, we talk about in the industry, we talk about colorblind casting.
Yeah.
And colorblind casting doesn't often happen. And that was one of the reasons that I jumped on the chance to do the role.
We want to, by the way, tell our listeners that we have two pairs of tickets left to Les Mis. That's for Saturday, November 2nd at 8 p.m. for a $50 pledge or more. And, of course, it is being presented by the Community Players of Salisbury at the Wicomico High School Auditorium. And, by the way, now, as I said, mentioned a moment ago, you've also involved with the American Spiritual Ensemble. What's going on with that? What are you guys doing these days?
Well, we've had several exciting projects. This summer, we had a tour of Spain, like 14th trip to Spain and a tour of all around Spain. A small quartet of us were also invited to Ireland this summer and to take part of JFK celebration, a commemoration of JFK Jr.'s visit there 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was able to sing for the Kennedy family and meet Caroline Kennedy and her children, and it was just an amazing experience. So our upcoming event related to the Spiritual Ensemble is November 17th, which is a University Chorale, Salisbury Chorale collaboration, and again, a quartet of American Spiritual Ensemble soloists.
John, in terms of your European tour and the spiritual music, how did you feel the music was received? Here you're singing in English and probably in dialect on occasion to a foreign audience, probably a non-English speaking audience by and large. How were you received by the Europeans?
I would say that the American Spiritual Ensemble is probably more popular in Europe than we are here. The Spiritual Ensemble in Spain, it's like we're like rock singers.
To what do you attribute that, John?
I think that, again, we go back to just like we're talking about universal themes in Les Mis, the themes of suffering and coming through a difficult period, and you combine that with beautiful melodies and people who appreciate music and beautiful, heartfelt, soulful music. I think you've just got a winning combination, mm-hmm. and that's a universal thing. And I can't even tell you, give you one example. We were in Bilbao, and they closed off the streets, and we were part of this annual festival, probably 500,000 people in the streets, and our concert began at midnight, and we could have stayed there all night singing. I mean, it was just something else. So I think that... It's the universality of these themes that
I would suggest you're absolutely right, because anytime you can strike a universal human chord, then you're going to pull people in and they're going to respond to what you're doing out of their own kind of humanness.
Yes, and you see that, Don. You see that in this throughout the show. Whenever I speak with various folks, there's inevitably a character. I ran into a colleague the other day that when I said we were doing Les Mis, she said, "Oh my goodness, I want to be Eponine. I wanted to be Eponine when I was in high school, and I still want to be Eponine." And I think that's a common thing.
Mm. And we want to remind people that we do have two pairs of tickets left for a pledge of $50 or more for the Saturday, November 2nd, 8 p.m. performance of Les Miserables, which, of course, is being presented by the Community Players of Salisbury, the Wicomico High School Auditorium. And, Hal, as a matter of fact, we made a bit use the other day of the Community Players. They came in, and that's going to be actually on the next Friday, your show. Tell us a little bit about sort of like got this sort of little radio play. Tell us a little about that.
What a lot of fun we had doing that, Don. And I did make a connection with the Community Players here in Salisbury, and they stepped right to the fore and provided four people for us for the reading. The reading is a dramatic reading. Of a horror story. This is going to be our kind of Halloween edition of the writers today. And we picked a short story by W.W. Jacobs entitled The Monkey's Paw, that, speaking of universal themes, that was published in 1902 and is an English piece, but does it speak to the human psyche, and as a result is a universal in its theme. I have to say, we did forego the British accents.
We did.
Though we didn't make that effort. But we did do a dramatic reading, and I redacted the short story into a radio drama, and I thought was quite a lot of fun, and I'm anxious to hear.
We just sat around and read yet.
Yeah, so I'm excited to hear it next week.
Again, the number is 410-543-6895. We're in the last day of our membership drive, and what we need you to do now is to pick up the phone, make the commitment. We have two pairs of tickets to Les Miserables. That's for the Saturday, November 2nd performance at 8 p.m. for a pledge of $50 or more. I want to also remind people that is being put on by the Community Players of Salisbury at Wacomico High School Auditorium. And one of the big features is, of course, John Wesley Wright, who is playing Jean Valjean. And, you know, and one of the things, as a matter of fact, I mean, I've seen a lot of the – matter of fact, one of the things that actually struck me in a number of the musicals was actually I was struck as to how good they were. I mean, it's, you know, because as you say, John, there's actually a lot of talent. I mean, it's really striking, and you go and some of the stuff. I mean, it's really pretty top notch, and you know, you're a great performer. You want to give us a little taste of what Jean Valjean sounds like, or
a little
music thing here. You got a little thing there?
Yeah. Okay. How about this? My favorite part, actually, in the show has become the epilogue. So you don't usually say, you know, my favorite part is dying, but it really is. And we have affectionately, I'm staged several times to walk out of my house and sit on a bench. And so we affectionately call it the think bench. So this is in the beginning of the epilogue, where Jean Valjean comes out, sits on his think bench, and he says, "Alone I wait in the shadows. I count the hours till I can sleep." And it goes on and on, and then there's a reprise of, "God on high, in my need, you have always been there," and you hear that tune again. So if you want to
hear that great voice, now's the time to pick up the phone. We have two pairs of tickets for Les Miserables at the Saturday, November 2nd performance. That's at 8 p.m. $50 pledge or more. Maybe we'll get John to come and sing at your house. Why don't I?
What I want to know is, if I pledge $50, do I get the
Do tickets? You get the free tickets? I see. Now, are you going to be sitting in the audience? Or are you just going to...
I can give them away.
Or you can give them away. That's true, too. Okay.
So you better call now.
That's right, because once he leaves the studio, that's it. He's got them. This is the last day of the membership drive, and we, of course, your community needs you to pick up the phone right now and dial 410-543-6895. Or if you, for instance, go online, you can certainly go to delmarvapublicradio.net, whichever works for you. That's up to you. And it's, we said, a $50 pledge for a pair of tickets. We got two pairs left for Les Mis. That's Saturday, November 2nd at 8 p.m. And we also want to commend the Community Players of Salisbury, who were not only putting on this production, but were so gracious in coming in and doing the radio reading that we had, that Hal sort of wrote up. And we appreciate the fact that Hal does his thing here. Every month he talks about writing.
Last Friday of the month.
That's right.
9 o'clock. tune in. It's a, we think anyway, that it's an excellent show for writers and for anyone interested in literary activities. So tune in at 9. Our show is expanded to an hour now. So we're going to be from 9 to 10. And we would like to have you on board for the broadcast.
Again, the number is 410-543-6895. That is the number. We've been talking with John Wesley Wright, who's here actually in Salisbury University, and also has a lead role in Les Miserables, the Jean Valjean. And I think, as we heard just a moment ago, it's got to be a great performance. But then again, every time John performs, it's a great performance. So there
That's
you go.
That's very kind of you to say.
Also, Hal Wilson, who's here, he's the host of our Writers Edition for Delmarva Today. And again, if you want a couple of pair of tickets there, it's 410-543-6895. That is the number to call, 410-543-6895. Go online, delmarvapublicradio.net. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
Delmarva Today is a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Don Rush is the host. Chris Rank is the executive producer and audio engineer. You can listen to this program again on our website, delmarvapublicradio.net. You can also view our program on PAC-14 television and on demand.
Support comes from Planet X Cafe, celebrating close to two decades.